Greetings, dear listener. We recorded this week's Doctor Who podcast before we'd heard the sad news about the passing of Doctor Who scriptwriter and Blake 7 script editor Chris Boucher. As a result, there is no mention of him within this podcast. However, we are now preparing a show which will pay some form of tribute to Boucher's vast contribution, not just to Doctor Who, but to British sci-fi TV as a whole. Welcome to the Doctor Who podcast with me, Christian Corley, and he's called James McLean. How are you doing? We both hope you're well. It's coming up to Christmas 2022. There's a few new things taking place in the world of Doctor Who. It's, I don't know, if I don't want to say it feels like the old days, but there's some things coming along, popping up, little leaks and things, and it does feel a little bit sort of like the old days, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm rubbing a warm hot water bottle, which is
very the old days,
on my belly, just like the old days. Yeah,
the essence of the old days. I'm wearing a very
tenderly caressing it.
Yeah, I'm wearing a very thick cardigan, the sort of thing you might expect a fisherman to be wearing, rather than a dynamic IT writer, or indeed me.
Just makes me think. I get flashes occasionally of old children books I would have known as a child, and something about a heavy fisherman's cardigan just chimes with something from my past, and I can't think what it is. And the problem with books is it's not very easy to find them. If you've got like flashes of them, it's not like a film or something. It's kind of harder to find. Mm-hmm. My sister and me were thinking of a book. There was a couple of books from the 80s we had. I think there were two separate books. There's one which was sort of like a picture book of going through space, but everything was made out of food. Everything was sort of food based.
Oh,
and there was
wow.
Another one which was a space race to the end, which I think it might have been three challenge sort of books, all again picture stories but slightly more adult. And again, finding those, that material, given there's so many books out there as well, and not that great in terms of archives, funnily enough, I don't think, on internet anyway. It's frustrating to have those little pinches of nostalgia that you can't quite grab because you just don't have access to them bar from your memory, which is obviously totally the opposite to the show that we talk about, where it is everywhere.
Well, yes. Yes, indeed. I mean, I like the sound of that. I wish I knew what it was myself, because that sounds like the sort of thing I would have right up my street.
Yeah, if I ever find it, I might start do another little hunt for it. But it's not even be able to remember their names. It's just those flashes and sensations of books which sort of engaged you in some way, but not that you remember their names.
That's a shame.
Yeah.
That's a shame. And did you have a lot of things with your siblings that you bonded over, that you enjoyed together?
Not massively. I mean, there's a bit of an age difference, but there were, you know, a few things which we would connect with, I guess. But yeah, I mean, yeah, what about you?
Not really, no. There's probably two things. There's definitely one thing, and the one thing is joking apart. It's virtually the only show my sister and I both sat down to watch together, which is the old Stephen Moffat comedy, if you're unaware of it, dear listener. Other than that, I mean, no, very little else at all. I can't think of anything, really. We're like two peas in a pod, really.
Yeah, no, I can't think of much that would sort of entertain the listener to hear about. I must admit, there probably is things. We've got a long history of shows that we used to watch. I mean, in the 90s, Homicide: Life on the Street was something that we'd both watch and we still talk about to this day occasionally.
Right.
Yeah, there's those sort of things, but they're childhood things. It's harder to remember. If you watched the Guardians holiday special, the Marvel Guardians holiday special.
Not yet, no. Galaxy. No, not yet. It's on the list of things to watch when the children have finished school.
Okay, because there's a bit in there which I won't spoil then. It's superfluous to the story, but I think it would be more amusing for you just to watch cold,
Okay.
with a callback to the 80s, which was fascinating to see, and just reminded me of some of the, I suppose I remember sort of things like the Wide Awake Club, the sort of
All right.
sensations of as a family, when you've been on school holidays of those, and the cartoons that they would have. And all the 80s sort of things which are sort of peripheral, which maybe not have been massively relevant to you, but still have that long-lasting impact on you.
Yeah, I have a Wide Awake Club recipe book. Still,
Wow,
to this day.
that's hardcore. Yeah.
Yeah, and I if I seem to recall, I bought it with my own pocket money from W.H. Smith, and there was probably one, maybe two things that I made in there: mashed potato hedgehog, or three things: mashed potato hedgehog. It's turning into the Spanish Inquisition. Mashed potato hedgehog. Hot dog fingers in bread with tomato sauce, blood everywhere. And my favorite was, for some reason, because they're quite gross, is dominoes made from a piece of bread cut to domino shape, and then some cream cheese made from butter and cheese.
Oh, for God's sake.
Yeah, and
Get in the bin.
and then currants as the spots. Now, bizarrely, I made that more than I made any of the other things. No explanation. I stand accused, and I am guilty of crimes against food.
Yes, I just, yeah.
Anyway, let's move on, because we do actually have some Doctor Who things to talk about, don't we? And I mean, you may know this, Dylan, you may not know this, but the TARDIS interior has been leaked online. Designs for the new, we guess it's the David Tennant slash Shudi Gatwa TARDIS, have been leaked online. They appeared on Reddit, as far as I'm aware, and then onto Twitter. There's been a copyright strike against them. James, I've sent you a new link where you can view them, just to refresh your memory, should you need to.
Okay.
There you go. And it's very, very roundly, and a little bit sort of. I think the console appears to be sort of floating-ish as well from the ceiling. Like a lot of those sort of 1990s designs. And there's also a police box interior door, as there has been many times since 2005, and Roundel sort of built out around that, as opposed to, say, the Capaldi TARDIS, which had that strange sort of squarishness around it before being merged into the surrounding. It also looks quite big as well, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It looks a lot. I remember some of the sort of concept art that they had around Russell T Davies era, if I recall. Was it the Davies era? Was it the Moffat era? I think it was the Davies era. Some of the early stuff that was sort of
Yeah.
there's a similar sort of aesthetic which was considered. But yeah, I think interestingly, because they've had so much of the adventures of time and space TARDIS in Doctor Who in the last, 6 years or so. Probably longer actually thinking about it. God, time does
Nearly
go doesn't it?
10,
But
yeah.
is it nearly 10 since that first appeared? Of course it will be,
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, yeah.
absolutely. Yeah, next year. We've had that sort of aesthetic isn't too alien or out of date now for newer viewers as well. So to
Yeah.
sort of take some of that aesthetic, give it some of that new series mix of as of Tennant slash second Smith slash as you said the Capaldi, and then with this sort of classical Adventures Time and Space, twice upon a time vibe, kind of all makes sense. It doesn't feel like you're really overly appeasing any party there because it is all built into the lore in the new series lore as well. Still not sure I like the police box doors. I've still always find that, and I understand the logic and I understand how it works, and in terms of the aesthetic and visibility and the sense it makes. At the same time, it still bothers me.
Well, I think, I mean, I know why it does. It it feels to me, from the moment I saw it, it just felt like the Cushing TARDIS, which in those days always felt like, maybe it's a little bit less so now, but, you know, back in 2005, the Cushing TARDIS, you know, those two movies always felt like something completely separate, well, not completely separate, but, you know, separate to TV Doctor Who, and it was something TV Doctor Who had never done before. So to have that sort of, you know, that,
It's a funny thing because, yeah, obviously the disconnect in the original to some degree kind of made sort of production sense. Oh, no, it probably didn't, to be honest. It's a weird one because, I mean, there was such a clear and almost confident disconnect in when it was originally done that you'd have a lot of shots of the open swing doors and you would see this a mock or part of the studio beyond. Which made no sense to the exterior. And it seemed the show seemed to be quite confident in that dissonance and the audiences would just have to deal with it, whether you saw that as just being the magic of a time-space machine or limitations of a show. It didn't care. And it was really odd because you kind of feel that that era would have been the era that you'd have put police box doors on the front of your console room just because... You just would do it, wouldn't you?
You're not
really thinking in deep temporal concepts. You're doing a show aimed primarily at children with the outside, the doors into the machine are police box. So inside, surely the indoors would be police box. And it is fascinating that they never really, and they never then tried to deviate from it. And it made sense as the show went on this notion that the exterior would change its shape. Then having that in the interior would be weird in terms of the concept. You wouldn't see it. It would just be the outer vessel would shift. And then we get to the new series where it actually becomes fixed. But now by this point, the lore is very clear that this is a vessel which can change its shape and its interior has no relationship to its exterior for that reason. And now it's embedded and it seems a bit weird. And now further on, where we're still very much embedded in that myth, it still seems weird that we've kept that. And the logic of it still seems a bit weird. I mean, the Jodie one was possibly the most logical of the recent of the new series, so far as it did feel like the exterior of your machine that can change shape is literally almost like the vestibule is latched onto the front of your interior. Yeah, I don't know. This is probably boring many people, but...
I don't think TARDIS interior talk balls Doctor Who fans. Yeah, well, but there's something else. A couple of interesting things about these images. The ones that we've seen, there's the illustration. Basically, if you're not able to see these images, because they may have been pulled down, again, I'll share with you in the show notes the most recent link I've got for these. So there's an illustration version, first of all, that's been photographed. It's up near or in the studio where they're building it, and you've got a sort of a David Tennant figure and for scale and the Wurlitzer jukebox. Do we think that's relevant?
I don't know. I mean, here's a question to you. Do you to show how organized we are, how do you feel about the fact that, I mean, this is something obviously the show is very keen to keep under wraps. And it's very unfortunate the leaks are out there. And obviously the argument is the leaks are out there, regardless of whether we say, you know, what we say. Mm. But there is that sort of issue, isn't there, about talking about this sort of thing which people are interested in and almost a natural part of accumulating engagement and excitement for something to come. And then obviously the desire of the production to keep this stuff under wraps. And I'm just thinking back to... a recent convention appearance that was recorded on YouTube, which I watched, which had, it was based on the Power of the Doctor. So you had Janet Fielding there. You had Sophie, Jenna, Peter Davison, Sylvester McCoy. And one of the things that Peter Davison was saying was how, in a weird way, it was frustrating having to keep such secrecy over their involvement in that show. And for that not to leak to the point where Sophie and Janet were going to set dressed in sort of hard helmets and masks and glasses to hide themselves. And it's like, surely if people knew that we were going to be in it, definitely would that have not increased the engagement and excitement and people watching the show? And I suppose we've got the same question here, is that, you know, we talk about this stuff because we know people want to talk about it because it engages them and excites them about the show coming up.
Yeah.
You know, is it a spoiler? Yeah, it is in a weird way, but as we've seen, you know, spoilers are part and parcel of engaging people's excitement and interest in a show, as seen with, we've gone back to it before, No Way Home, you know, and all that and all that sort of material where people are desperate to know what's going on to get some feeling of what it will be like. And yet at the same time, there is that creative powers which would really like to surprise you.
So what question were you asking me?
I suppose the question I was asking you, let me just contemplatively rub my hot water bottle, was, you know, how do you feel about, like, you know, sort of putting the stuff in the show notes, kind of gives a platform to this sort of spoilerness, which the show itself would rather people didn't see.
Oh, right. Okay. You know, I see.
Do you see
how
that
do
sort
I
of ground?
Feel about that? I think it's fine.
Yeah. Well, that was it, and that's kind of what I was justifying in the
because, you know, we're talking about, so we have to give a reference to the listener, otherwise we're kind of just, you know, there. I mean, we don't have to give a reference to the listener. It's just nice to give a reference to the listener so they can see what we're talking about. I mean, you know, if they're not interested in the idea of this type of spoiler, they're very, I mean, and that's absolutely fine, because they may prefer to, you know, they don't have to click that link. They may prefer to just wait until Doctor Who's on to see that TARDIS interior. That's absolutely fine. And they can skip this section as well. But
absolutely. But they will miss me caressing my hot water bottle because it is getting colder now, so I'm going to be doing it less.
Okay.
Yeah. They don't stay warm forever, Christian.
No, they don't. No, I've noticed that. Have you not got one of those little ones with a little thing in it that you pop and it creates a chemical reaction and turns it into a sort of a hard gel? One of those ones. They stay warm for a while.
It's just a rubber hot water bottle with hot water in it.
Okay. You can get long hot water bottles now. I don't know why. I think they're to sort of lie alongside you in bed. But from what I can remember, there's with a greater surface area, you're more likely to lose the heat quicker. So I'm not really sure why that is a thing.
Yeah. Interesting. No, I'm a bit old school.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so that's a hot water bottle talk on the podcast with a K. Russell T. Davies has said that it takes a while to get the Empire in shape, but that's a serious plan. Annual Doctor Who, no gap years, lots of content, on and the Seuss 14 will be 8 episodes long and we'll see the return of Christmas specials. Now, I'm not sure if that means Seuss 14 will be 7 episodes long in its initial run, and then the Christmas special will be 8, or if it's 8 episodes long, then the Christmas special will be separate, so it's actually going to be 9. That isn't clear. But Christmas specials will be back, and I think they're planning to go a bit longer with subsequent series. But gap years have been a problem for Doctor Who, haven't they? We think.
Yeah. But thankfully, a hot talking point for ourselves.
Yes. Most definitely. Something else that's been said is that Russell T. Davies has said this, that scene that we've all seen with Shuti Gatwa, with the what appears to be the same location where Jodie and David Tennant were in terms of the background, we're never going to see that again because they faked it.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And they faked it for a reason. So that background has been put in basically so we can see him in the trailer. For the obvious reason, but it's not. Yes.
Well, that's kind of good, I think, isn't it? Because we're all a little disturbed with the idea of, for some reason, going back to that point for whatever reason. But, well, disturbed is probably a hard phrase, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. So, yes. So that's interesting to know. I think there's a... Now, we've gathered here today to have a little chat. I've just... Oh, right. Okay, it's Peter Kay. Sorry. Oops, sorry, everyone. Peter Kay just popped up on my Twitter feed because he's going back on tour. Doctor Who context, we can do it. And he's going back on tour. He's already started his new tour and he's just added dates. I tried to get dates to see Peter Kay. Me and Kerry thought we'd give it a go because we usually go for small comedy things. And we thought, because it's Peter Kay, we make an exception, go for a big comedy thing. Although I regret it now because, you know, it was an absolute waste of several hours trying to buy tickets. But
wow.
Yeah. And do you know, the day before I bought the Peter Kay tickets, I bought Weird Al Yankovic tickets. Took 5 minutes.
No, that doesn't surprise me. No offense to Weird Al.
But... Yeah, I know. Yeah. So, so going to see Weird Al next year in February, I think it is. Last night, I went to a, I know no one's asking, but I'm still quite excited about it. I went to
I wasn't going to say that, but carry on.
I went to I don't get invited to things very often, and mainly because they're in London, but this was in Newcastle, and, or as they say there, Newcastle, and it was a new bar that's like a retro arcade bar. It's a branch of Four Quarters. There's one in Bristol, and there's three in London, and this is the first one outside the south, basically. And I was speaking to one of the co-founders. He told me that they're like the original UK retro bar franchise brand, because there's a few of them now. So got invited there. I took my wife, and we spent a few hours playing retro games for free, like proper old style arcades. No Raspberry Pis or PCs inside them. They're actual original boards and everything like that. And it's the first time I've been to any sort of like press event or anything, like press launch or event launch or anything like that. Kerry goes to them all the time now. As a counsellor, I don't go to anything. I had such a great time. I'm still buzzing. Oh, it was fun, fantastic. And we weren't even there for the whole night, but it was just good to get out the house. Anyhow, now I've found the link. as I was saying a few moments ago, we've got together because there's a few little bits and bobs to talk about that will be of interest to Doctor Who fans. The next one I've got is the Midjourney AI, James. Twitter user called Christian Erickson has, this is what he says. I asked Midjourney AI to render a portrait of every version of Doctor Who with no information other than First Doctor, Second Doctor, etc. And the results are hilarious. It has clearly indexed some of these faces more than others. I dig how it made number six look like Rutger Hauer. I'm not seeing that, but I am seeing some amazing sort of faces for the doctors. And number six, I'm not getting Rutger Hauer. I'm getting some sort of, I've only just noticed the costumes are absolutely crazy as well. What do you think of it?
I was, if I'm totally honest and being a bit of the party pooper, I just hate the AI stuff. From a design point of view, it's sort of, from an artist perspective, the sort of the not just the morality of it, but also the concerns, as you say, that the stuff generated is always quite interesting, can be quite interesting. And interesting because we know it's an AI is what makes it interesting, rather than the question of the art itself.
Yeah.
You know, how it's sourcing and coming to the decisions it makes. So yeah, I could see the interest of it, but I must admit, I think there was some sort of moral righteousness inside that had me just not engaging at all. Just not engaging, just like, you know, this just the implications of this. And I see so many artists on Twitter feeling more and more either pressured or frustrated at, obviously, the way AIs work in siphoning through material and their material sort of being used. It just puts me off the whole thing. But...
Well, I mean, that's absolutely fair point. I've been involved over several months. I've bailed on it now. There's a company that advertises on Facebook, like an AI, artificial intelligence creation of articles for blogs, for websites, that sort of thing. And they try to... It came up in my feed and I responded that this was just like absolutely unacceptable. They shouldn't be doing this. They're going to, you know, they're going to price people out of careers, yeah, and that sort of thing. And they started getting really aggressive with me. What the hell have you got to be aggressive about? You're building like robots to steal people's livings here. And, you know, if you're that confident about it, I don't think that like one guy who you haven't heard of having an opinion on this is much for you to be worried about. I think it might be actually the pylon actually started when I cited some credentials. Then they started getting concerned. You know, mentioning make use of Future Publishing and various other places that I'd contributed to. I think that's when it probably started. But
I was just going to say, I just remember, you know, back in my early days when I would be reading 2000 AD, and, you know, the Judge Dredd back in the 80s, there was always this notion that 90% of the city was unemployed, you know, because robots did everything.
Yeah.
So part of the problem of the high crime that the system had to deal with was the fact that people were bored and they had nothing to do, and they didn't have that much to do because there was no real money being generated. There was no, you know, there was no capitalism at you know, really anymore, apart from this very fringe level. So, I mean, I suppose some could say that was a, you know, some sort of dystopian slash utopia, but communist dream, I don't know. But I've never really explained how people live, how poor they are, or whatever. But this idea of there being like no employment left, and you see this sort of stuff going on, and you feel like, well, what are you siphoning out? What's going to be left?
Yeah.
You know, where the pleasure is going to be, and really, where's what, you know, I suppose the sad thing with technology, and it's, you know, when it's new, often the sheer spectacle of it means we have no idea. But it's like, what is the application of this apart from creating cheap resources and reducing the need for skilled people? You know, what does this bring apart from unhappiness for others and the small profits perhaps for companies which benefit, you know, who promote it? I don't know where it's going to go. And going back to the Doctor Who thing, all those questions were in my head so much so I couldn't actually really focus on you know, the genuine interests of what was actually being done there.
I mean, going back to that photo, it reminds me that, you know, that time when we talked about those that YouTube video, those I think it was a YouTube video, potential American castings of Doctor Who, if Doctor Who was an American show. So you had people like Carl McLaughlin and various others who are Gene Wilder as well, and people like that suggested as sorry, Gene Wilder was suggested for the fourth Doctor and Carl McLaughlin for the fifth Doctor, I think, or something like that. These images, these AI generated images of we've got 9, 6, we've got 15 doctors, including the War Doctor and the Renegade Doctor. They remind me of that. I mean, for instance, the second Doctor, it's William Hurt, isn't it? And completely in the wrong place, clearly. The Peter Davison, someone's noted that the Peter Davison looks like he works in high finance and says yeah instead of yes. It's given Peter Davison a sort of filled out face with a square jaw. Tom Baker looks like what someone might think Tom Baker looks like. I think Chris Eccleston looks like Will Self. Matt Smith looks like Matt Smith.
Yeah.
Jodie Whittaker looks like a sort of 19-year-old cosplayer. The Renegade Doctor looks it's completely different to her as you can imagine, really. She looks sort of, she reminds me of someone. I can't quite put my finger on who it is, an actress, a different actress. Peter Capaldi's scaring me, the 12th Doctor with those eyes. It's a funny old thing. And then you've got the Colin Baker thing. And also, I've noticed as well, I didn't notice this initially, but it's also affected the costume. Their outfits aren't right either. So Peter Davison, the 5th Doctor, has got more stripes. The 4th Doctor's apparently wearing three scarves, and the 6th Doctor is not... I mean, what is going on there? It's like, it's an outfit I've seen. I just can't put my finger on where I've seen it. Possibly... Joseph and his amazing Technicolor dream coat, but literally. And also, there's a cravat going on with the 6th Doctor. Which is the wrong colour cravat. It's more in a sort of a Jason King style wearing of the cravat rather than the 6th Doctor's wearing. It's all just so weird and alt universe and crazy, isn't it? And the 3rd Doctor looks like a really grumpy grandparent who you've just pissed off. It's a weird thing. It really is. So check that out in the show notes. And consider how much the first Doctor resembles Dobby when you get there.
And then think on to the moral implications.
Yes, definitely do that.
Of AI-generated media.
I think it's going to be one of those technologies that a very small portion of it ends up being used long term, like this initial sort of big arrival of it is largely people just don't care for it much, but there's some useful technology part in it that they're able to carry on using in other purposes. Because again, with the writing thing, I've played with some of these AI writing things just to see what the competition was like, and they're not up to scratch. And I know there's a new one around at the moment which people have been using. I think Gareth Roberts on Twitter, the Doctor Who writer Gareth Roberts, tweeted something where he'd tried it out with a conversation between the Prime Minister and the Leader of the Opposition, and it's still got a long way to go, and that's just one type of AI.
But I suppose for art it's a little different, because it can borrow and create and present something quite beautiful by utilising,
yeah,
in a way that writing is a little more difficult.
Yes.
Because there's a certain rhythm and cadence that, you know, you can sort of, it's got to be absolutely right. But I mean, I think it's just that question, isn't it, of where culture or society is just never able to keep up with technology, you know, where technology goes is faster than we can sort of work out what it is, what it means, and whether we need to safeguard or whether we need to, you know, how you know, where the problems and benefits from it. And well, I suppose we're in, yeah, that sort of space.
I imagine. I'm just throwing this out there. When they start AI generating dance music and R&B, will anyone notice?
Yeah.
That is the question.
Or Police songs.
Police, what, songs by Sting and the other guys?
They're all the same, aren't they? They all have that same sort of repetitive chorus. I mean, it's very cruel because I'm a big fan of Rocket from the Crypt, which is probably far more guilty of that. But so niche that no one will know what I'm talking about, so it's safe.
The band that used to annoy the hell out of me for only having one song, the Spin Doctors.
Yeah.
They got away with murder, those guys. Three songs probably that were all identical.
And in fairness to the Police, I mean, their songs are actually far harder to play and perform well than they actually sound. So while I sort of mock a certain similarity in some of the way that they, in their vibe and their construct, they were actually technically quite smart. And I've seen people trying to perform them several times, and, you know, it's very hard to get right. So if you like the Police, that's actually not particularly too much of a criticism, because they were very smart, and I do actually like quite a few of their songs.
Well, sort of, right, and certainly Stuart Copeland's an amazing drummer. So
yeah, that's, yeah, the alone. Drumming was part of the, yeah, the rhythm and drums, you know, bass drums were particularly a hard bit. But there's lots of things. There's a lot of, again, that sort of style is actually quite hard to actually get right. You know, it takes a bit of skill. So
yeah,
no criticism for anyone.
Yes.
Yeah, but yes, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things which I think we're going to see more of and more concerns of. And I sort of kind of feel for, as you say, artists and potentially writers and other media people who are at the moment feeling disconcerted about this thrust of interest and not knowing where it's going to go.
Yeah, so try that link and have a look at those AI-generated doctors and see if it gives you nightmares. We'll move on now to, you've watched Andor, haven't you?
Yes.
Right. I'm midway through it, so I'll try and keep the spoiler level low here. I'm really enjoying it. Gareth Cavanagh, when I was speaking to him a few weeks ago, I don't know if he mentioned it on the podcast or if it was after we recorded, he likened it, he said it was essentially, they've remade Blake 7. And while that's not, you know, it isn't Blake 7, I can see absolutely where he's coming from with it. And it starts off kind of low-key and then it's building up, and I'm really enjoying it. Now, someone has created a YouTuber channel called Oral Knot, created an Andor 1975 TV intro. Absolutely loving it.
I'll have to watch that. I've not seen this.
Yes, you should watch it. Definitely watch it. I could press play on it now, but you'd just get the audio, so it wouldn't have the same effect.
It's interesting that you say Blake 7, because it's almost like Andor, the first 10 episodes is almost like the equivalent of Blake 7, but the first episode of Blake 7, maybe the second, to be fair,
yeah,
where it is just pretty much Blake struggling on Earth and then Blake struggling on a prison ship. So before they find the Liberator and become the Robin Hood in space, it does have that same sort of quality to it. And the universe especially does as well. So I think it's an interesting point.
It's I'm really enjoying it. I mean, I enjoyed Obi-Wan Kenobi, but I think that was mainly I was enjoying performances in Obi-Wan Kenobi, you know? Whereas with this, it's more of an ensemble piece, and it feels far more just like Rogue One did, I suppose. It feels more original, and not really, it doesn't really owe anything to Rogue One apart from the star. But it can stand on its own two feet.
But I think, I know you're not doing this, I think the problem with the output that we're getting now from big franchises and big franchise output is the need to cross-compare. And what Obi-Wan is doing from a different space perspective, yeah, and interest than what Andor is doing, which for some people watching it might find it too oppressive, too humorless, and just an escapism into a world where you don't want to escape to, while with Obi-Wan, again, not exactly a humor-filled world, but there's perhaps a little more charm or hope in it. And I suppose, as you just said, you know, with Andor being connected to Rogue One, you know that this is a hopeless journey is the wrong, because the outcome does have historical benefit to the universe, but for his journey,
yeah,
it's a dark path. So again, it depends what you want. I mean, you can enjoy, as I think we said, you can really enjoy Moon Knight for Marvel and yet still enjoy She-Hulk, and yet they're totally different. And it's a shame when I see people sort of trying to compare the two, going that one is trash and one is excellent, or both are trash. And it's just like, you know, you've got to decide, you've got to see what these shows are trying to do and what they're, and assess whether they're successfully doing it.
Yeah.
And well, even if it's not something you'd like.
There is a difference which a lot of people kind of overlook, because, you know, they feel that their opinions are definitive. But there is a difference between saying this is trash and I think this is trash, or I feel this is trash. Those things are completely different, aren't they?
I didn't enjoy this. Cannot be enjoyed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I get that. I mean, I The Werewolf by Night for Marvel, I watched, it left me a bit cold, to be honest. I could see what it was doing. It did it well, but it just didn't engage me. I just, for some reason, it just didn't do much for me, but that's just me. Are there things which shows and films and media do wrong, or, you know, that you can criticize objectively? Objectively, possibly not, but you can make strong critiques and make strong arguments against certain things being done where they did or didn't work. But yeah, I get your point. I think it would be nice if everyone just took a step back a bit and just actually sort of, we live in a world of us, isn't it, of me. And it's like, if something doesn't appeal to me, there's something inherently wrong with it. And it can be sort of like, well, you know, I watched Wednesday on Netflix, and I kind of, with my friend, and we were both kind of like, it's all right, but I don't know. It's the teen drama is a bit predictable. The boys in it are a bit, you know, the bit high, and the high school level. And the internal logic doesn't seem to be there. But hey, it's probably aimed at a sort of, 14 to 18 demo, or 14 to 16 demographic, largely. It's not aimed at me. So, yeah, you know, to some degree, I've got to watch it with a pinch of salt, knowing that there's going to be a lot of things in here which won't speak to my understanding of the world. And I think that's the thing with Andor, isn't it? Andor speaks very much to people who, potentially older people who grew up with Star Wars, and it's kind of reflection of 70s life and the world of the 70s. There is a sort of dark cynicism to Star Wars, which is the backdrop to this exciting fantasy adventure you know, yes, it's a let's go and rescue the princess, you know, the errant knight and his and you know, his anti-hero sidekick, but ultimately it's a story of world being destroyed for no reason, with no justice whatsoever, and no real comeuppance for it. You know, it's a dark universe, and that's what Andor explores. And I think older people perhaps tap into that, while Obi-Wan Kenobi perhaps taps in more to sort of millennial. So, you know, you could say Andor really taps into Gen X. Obi-Wan perhaps taps more into millennial, where Ewan McGregor was very much part of their growing up with the prequels. And him alone gives that meaning. So yeah, it's just, it's interesting. And it's the same with Doctor Who, isn't it? It's you know, Power of the Doctor is a good example, isn't it, of what people get out of that. And for, you know, as I say, some of the older fans, sort of moments of Peter Davison and Janet Fielding speaking about Adric carries big impact, because that had a big impact for them when they were a child, seeing, you know, this character be killed off. Or, you know, the breakdown, the inevitable breakdown of the Doctor and Ace relationship being acknowledged, and them finding, you know, those have real big meaning. But for a younger person, is the excitement of seeing UNIT again. And, you know, it's hard to see, it's different spaces, isn't it? Different things that appeal.
It's funny, that scene, actually, that collection of scenes, actually, because I'm not really sure which aspect of it I enjoy the most. I suppose, I mean, being honest, it's probably just McGann being there, really. And that's, you know, and I agree with you with the two conversations that you refer to, but it's the fact that McGann's there.
Why do you think that's? Because there's a part of you which still feels that McGann is so disconnected from the television. There's a sort of satisfaction.
Yeah, I think it probably is. And because the thing is, with Paul McGann and Doctor Who, he had everything except a show, didn't he, basically? Mm. You know, so, you know, all the other Doctors, they've had a show. And maybe not great scripts. The McGann script wasn't great, but you know, it had direction. They had plans for it, and it looked amazing. And he was just fantastic from the moment. Like, you know, maybe later, Doctor since him have, you know, come, you know, out of the starting block straight away. I think he was the first one of the classic Doctors, maybe. Yeah,
yeah.
Just hits the ground running. And you know, with everything, you know, the spin-off media was a bit limited at first, with just like the comic strips in Radio Times and the Doctor Who magazine and the BBC books. Then, you know, obviously he got involved with Big Finish 2003-ish or whatever, whenever it was. It just felt like there is still a disconnect, and that he was like, you know, he said himself at the time, straight after filming it, that he was really just going to be the George Lazenby of Doctor Who. And in many ways he has been, except of course, he's not a bit of a dick.
But I think also in the terms of the way the BBC either handled it, or maybe had to handle it in terms of licensing, I'm not entirely sure, but he was kind of omitted from all the sort of Doctor Who documentaries and references the BBC would do up to 2005. It would never be referenced, as if it never existed.
Yeah.
And again...
Well, he's not in day of what's the Doctor Destiny of the Doctors, which came out in 98. And and McGann's not in there. It goes up to McCoy.
So I think, as you say, there's a sort of almost like an erasure of him, which has always been a little frustrating, that even when the show came back, that it took so long really for him to be acknowledged, given that. And I know it wasn't their duty to make up for that, because it wasn't them who you know, erased him. But, you know, when we know audiences thrive on this so much, it's, as we said in a previous podcast not long ago, it's amazing how long it's taken for this sort of thing to really be sort of drawn into Doctor Who and into other franchises, but especially Doctor Who, which has a history of being very self-aware and bringing back its own continuity. Some characters in the continuity have taken a lot longer than I'd have expected to have come back.
Yeah.
And audiences always thrive on it. And I think as long as you don't make it too much of your story that newer audiences are put off by it, there's always room to do this. And yeah, but they sort of got hooked on Sarah Jane and then it all sort of disappeared again.
Am I right in thinking that, I think I am right, unless I'm missing something. The first time in the 2005 onwards Doctor Who series where the previous Doctors were acknowledged, aside from the Doctor meeting Sarah Jane, was the next Doctor with the info stamp thing.
I mean, if you're very particular, End of the World has that graphic which suggests multiple timelines that that pops up, which was like the first time that kind of suggested. It had no images of the Doctors or anything, but as I recall, there was a graphic which suggested multiple strands of the Doctor that there had been, and whether there was 8 previous ones, I think there might have been, which would, and I think the reason I bring it up is I think there might have been 8, but okay. It's been a long time, and that could be arguably your first reference to the fact that there had been 8 incarnations prior, which would include McGann, yeah. But that would be very nuanced, and I'm not 100% sure on that. Like I say, show on the Facebook, just let us know if I'm right or wrong on that.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, but yeah, you're right. I think, in as you say, natural, because I remember the excitement in The Next Doctor of seeing all those characters appear on the screen and that sort of real acknowledgement of the history, which Davis had been very cautious about over-focusing on, I think.
Yes, yes.
But again, this is what audiences want. This is what audiences like. When you've got such a tapestry where you can pick and choose and drop, and a story format, which means you can drop in Ace without having to really explain who the hell she is, and quite frankly, Power of the Daleks does not. That's a good thing, isn't it? It means that you can keep your story rolling on for everyone else, but have something in there which might have a meaningful impact for a certain section of your fans.
Yeah, yeah. I think as well, I mean, I think this, it might just be me and it might be just my age, I think people are a little less forgiving to all the TV shows now as well. So in 2005 up to 2010, really, Russell T Davies was very careful to keep Doctor Who largely, you know, classic Doctor Who at arm's length because it didn't have, largely because it didn't have the same production standards as the modern show. And it, in the public perception, it had kind of gone out with a whimper and not a bang. Whereas now, I think post-2013 in particular, there's more of an, and it's not just with Doctor Who, it's with lots of shows, I think.
Yeah.
There's more of an affection, that's more of a gentle view of older TV shows.
I mean, I think also it could be a little bit that with Davis, and again, it's always annoying that we have to speak about this without knowing what Davis genuinely was thinking. But, you know, when you're trying to sell this as its own product, its own show, and thinking about abroad as well. And as you say, you know, you want to be developing a singular vision, a singular aesthetic product. And that old show was a complicated mess of styles, mess of quality. And as you say, you might not want to have your show that you are selling overseas as well to have that sort of connection.
Yeah.
It's okay to acknowledge its, you know, long-running existence, showing its longevity. But ultimately, as you say, what it was doing doesn't match the standards of what you do now. And, you know, that's part of being a good producer, is kind of working, you know, feeling out the vibe, because we all know Davis loves that old show. It's not that he wanted to pretend it didn't exist because he didn't approve of it. There's no sort of Michael Grade thing going on here. This is about him making decisions which were in benefit of the show. But now, as you say, yeah, there's a, I think possibly, I mean, in the last 10 years, the world has changed, hasn't it, with streaming and access and libraries.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And binge-watching all TV shows, and you've got all those free streaming shows that you can watch on the internet, and they are piping old American TV shows into your eyes.
But I think there's also, free. And I don't think this is necessarily Doctor Who, because again, I can't imagine this being true, but there's always been a resistance to overly try it and find ways to tap into past legacies. As if, and I, a part of that, I mean, this is why it's not talking specifically about Doctor Who, because often this is because, again, if we go back to the No Way Home, where you have Sony owning those two previous iterations of Spider-Man, and the complexities of bringing that together as three is harder. But I mean, the rewards, if you can do it, because people do have long memories and they do like to engage in this sort of material, and they do like that sort of acknowledgement of those different worlds that they've, you know, that they've experienced as part of their life.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of revenue and potential there, which I think is, as we've said recently, only in the last few years is, for various reasons, do we see that being tapped, and largely because through the comic book genres, because that itself is a complex web of iterations, isn't it? So
yeah,
we know DC were doing it before No Way Home did with its TV shows, with its Arrowverse, and sort of bringing in Smallville and and bringing in the Flash from the 90s. And you know, obviously, if the Flash film does ever appear, you know, Michael Keaton might reappear. Last attempt has been nixed. We'll see if this next one is. You know, these are big ways of celebrating. I think celebrating the medium, and I think that's maybe where television has kind of forgotten the fact that for people, the medium is their lives. You know, it's a strong part of their growing up. It's a strong part of their adulthood. It's a family friend, isn't it? That they revisit parts of that memory and to be reunited. So it's not just simply about nostalgia, but, you know, coming back and seeing your old friends and seeing, you know, Ace and the Doctor standing there is a very powerful thing. You know, these people in a weird way exist. And going back to the original point, the erasure of these characters for the show to move onwards and not really acknowledge this sort of stuff is, you know, it, that's not what audiences really want. Even if it can be good for the program, it's not what they want. And, you know, like with Ace never having an out of the show, that kind of now having been rectified is a complication of our television histories, our family television history, which has been sorted. And even having Mel in that room.
Yeah.
Because again, Mel goes off with Glitz, which is a bit of a worrying pair that just does not work in any way whatsoever. Typical classic Doctor Who. And I know one of the Steve Lyon books tries to reconcile some of that, but it's an odd pairing. See her on Earth again gives us something. So yeah, I'm monologuing on this. It's just really interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is. So just to rewind back to the inspiration for that, the Andor 1975 TV.
Oh yes, yeah.
Even if you've not watched Andor, it's worth checking out this, because it's a very nice kind of pastiche and tribute to 1970 sci-fi TV shows.
Which you haven't seen yet, have you?
So you check that out.
No, I've not. But I mean, I think with Andor in specifically, as you say, and with Rogue One specifically, that 70s aesthetic has been very much part of its world building.
Yeah, yeah.
So it kind of makes sense. And
it totally fits, yeah.
It is really fascinating when you see fans sort of produce this sort of content which tries to understand or reconceptualize their shows through these different sort of viewpoints. There's a great, the Space 1999 theme, there's some great versions, we've talked about this before, of them co-opting Doctor Who and doing Doctor Who using that sort of theme. I saw the other day one where they did it with Coronation Street. Someone done the Space 1999 to about 1980s Coronation Street. And again, it's that weird way of just in our brains trying to conceptualize, what if Anders was done in that time period? What if that was part of the, you know, the Star Wars legacy leading up to A New Hope, you know, being the end of almost like a trilogy, Andor, Rogue One, and A New Hope. What would that be like? And that sort of material gives us a sort of sensation of what that would be like.
Yeah, it does feel very 70s watching it. There's like scenes, there's a character who loses his job and goes to see, mm-hmm. I think it's his mother. Those scenes remind me of 2001. Those sort of like square on views of them sat eating. So things like that.
And that was very interesting, isn't it? Because Coruscant, as it's depicted in the special edition for Return of the Jedi and in the Clone Wars animated series and the like, was very, the aesthetic of it was not very 70s. In fact, it was used a lot, wasn't it, in the prequels? And there it felt more sort of more of the Art Deco sort of opulent style was very much a lot of Coruscant. And we always knew that below that level, that there was meant to be a far sort of more, probably a far more brutal aesthetic.
Yeah.
And as you say, you get that. And they find the bits of Coruscant, which just about feels again like it matches the 70s, but could never have been done in the 70s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the Mon Mothma stuff is really interesting in terms of the style of her world, which is very different. And it doesn't feel out of place.
Yeah. I like how they've done that as well. Anyway, we're you need to check that out, dear listener, if Andor interests you. Do get on board with that while you can. We're going to finish with this. Now, this has been doing the rounds for a while. This is from George and the Dragon, which is an old TV show starring Sid James and I think Peggy Mount. And it features Tom Baker. Now, I think you can listen to this and you don't really need to see it. Basically, they are on a platform waiting for a train.
It's late again.
Yes, well, it's a new system. They've stopped using timetables. They use a calendar.
They've never been the same since they were naturalized.
Ah, Porter. Yes, ma'am. What do you want?
Well, it's courtesy week again.
How long will the 10:15 train be?
Including the engine, about 130 feet.
So that is Tom Baker as a as a guard, as a train guard, I think, on a platform, cracking a little joke and making Sir James laugh. And then the bit I love the most, well, it's not the bit I love the most, I love all of Tom Baker's appearances. There's just where he guffaws to himself as he walks off at the end. It's, well, yeah, Tom Baker, eh?
It's funny, you get actors who you never quite understand where they come from. I mean, I was watching a few months ago a really early, suddenly his name's escaped from me. Isn't it annoying that happens on a podcast?
Yes.
From The Fly, Jeff Goldblum.
Jeff Goldblum.
A very early Jeff Goldblum film, which he leads in it. It's sort of done in Croatia. And he's just Jeff Goldblum. And it's like, where does that come from? Because you're used to that Jeff Goldblum performance. But I can't think of anyone in the history of television that has done that sort of performance as a character. Because Jeff Goldblum doesn't really exist. He's a sort of weird, a bit like Shatner, someone that just that feels real, but just doesn't really, there's a sort of uncanny valley there. And it's the same with Tom Baker, you know, especially in that clip. It's like he is so out of sync with that style of comedy, and yet and I think that's what makes Sid James laugh about it, because that role should not have the potency that it has in that moment.
No.
And it's only there because of him. From, you know, the way he bends down.
That's crazy, you know? Isn't it? I mean, it's obviously necessary because he's so tall and the camera angle's so low because they're sat down, but yeah, it's so funny.
It doesn't feel natural. It feels like it's something to do with the actor, because I've never seen that sort of staging in that sort of era of comedy. Everything about it just feels uncanny. And that's to do with Tom Baker. It's just like, where do you get the courage to be yourself in a lot of ways, in that sort of space, which at the time, you know, was big, you know, big show.
Yeah.
And yet you still yourself. And as I say, same with Jeff Goldblum. It's these weird, larger than life personalities.
Is Christopher Walken on that list?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose his has got a sort of slightly more, it's not so much over the top, it's sort of more the sort of depiction of internally screaming is Christopher Walken, isn't it? There's just like, he feels like he's a genie in the bottle, that if you pop the top, the stuff that come out would just destroy countries, because it's just such a sort of intensity, but such a passive intensity.
Yeah.
As if, yeah, it's a really odd performance. But yeah, I suppose you're right. I mean, I suppose you could say there's a lot of, in some of his performances, of the sort of gangster element that sits there in the background, but he's never playing a gangster, apart from potentially maybe Batman Returns, you could argue. But yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. It is interesting to find these sort of types of actors which are larger than life, which, I don't know, create an archetype which never really feels like it was there before. I'm sure there must be Jeff Goldblums out there. That's the star which I've missed, which he riffed on. And the same for Tom Baker. But I suppose it's hard with Tom Baker because he is so British. And, you know, there's sort of slight Liverpudlian stuff there. You know, it's not an area which tends to, prior to that period, you didn't get a lot of people, to be honest, from the North on television, in British television. It was very much still very much institutionalized, in my memory anyway. You know, apart from some big names, you know, you know, there was a lot of British actor vibe to it.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, Morecambe and Wise, both from the North, don't...
Well, that's what I was trying to say. There's nothing broad about it.
Coronation Street, the accents in Coronation Street around that time there, I mean, and now really, although they come from all over the place in Coronation Street these days, but, you know, back then, there was very few very broad accents in Coronation Street. There was
but that in itself was, as far as I'm aware, because it's, again, before my time, was quite unusual.
Yeah.
You know, this sort of very, as you say, Northern... soap world, which, you know, you didn't really get those sort of depictions within British television broadcasting.
I mean, there are studies that television's changed accents, isn't there? And in many cases, sort of softened accents, or in some cases, I mean, there's a lot of people contribute or believe that Liverpool, the Liverpool accent has kind of got stronger over the years. Rather than become sort of more mellow as accents have in other places. And then you've got people like Gerald, not our Gerald, of course, whose button I was going to press and realise it wasn't labelled, but Gerald from Clarkson's Farm. He's got this very... I'm not sure... Where is that Sussex or Surrey? I think it's Surrey. He's got this very, very, very broad accent that I find... I know everyone watching it finds it very difficult to work out what you're saying.
I was watching when I wasn't very well a couple of weeks ago. Decided to go back and watch Red Dwarf from the beginning.
Right.
And again, you take Lister, you know, a very real Liverpudlian accent.
Yeah.
And leading the show. And, you know, by the 80s, that was not, I mean, I remember watching Red Dwarf, I was never blown away by it. So it was obviously not something which was inherently unusual, but at the same time, kind of is, to have such regionality, such Northern regionality. And I appreciate people from coming up to your level of the North don't consider that area to be the North. There's lots of debates around that, but, yeah, you didn't tend to get that sort of regionality in the voice. And I suppose some of that's obviously to do with selling overseas.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I mean, yeah, I suppose it's
fascinating.
Back in those days, I mean, it's obviously far more common now. Back in those days, I mean, there was an ITV show with a Liverpudlian actress that Lisa Tarbuck was in, but she wasn't the main character; she was like the secondary character. I can't remember what it was called. Oh, Watching, that was it. And then you had, like, Why Don't You, didn't you? Where you'd have, like, Why Don't You teams in, like, Northern Ireland and Wales and Bristol and probably other places, but I can't remember. Presumably Manchester at some point, or Scotland. Glasgow, probably. I would have struggled with the Glaswegian ones. But beyond those, there weren't, even in the 80s, late 80s, there weren't an awful lot of non-RP or not so much non-RP, but very kind of... What's really the right way of putting this? Because these weren't really RP accents that we were getting, but they were kind of naturalized, isn't a word I want to use, but
yeah, it's interesting because I'm very cautious about sort of making, you know, because we've obviously, as usual, we've not researched this section, so it's just naturally become part of the conversation. Not really looked at it well enough to be able to sort of say, and it'd be very easy for someone on our Facebook page to turn around and go, actually, you're both totally wrong, and, you know, you've made massive assumptions and missed all X, Y, and Z. But yeah, you had the RP, which is very much part of broadcasting for a long time, I wonder where regionality started to become become more noticeable. And, you know, one wonders whether, you know, children's shows was a space.
Yeah.
Where that might be. Because I was thinking, you know, you used to talk about late 80s, but I was thinking like Biker Grove.
Yes, yes.
You know, the birth of PJ and Duncan Anton Deck. You know, and that again was extremely regional.
Yeah, yeah.
And as you say, why don't you had a lot of region, and maybe, I don't know. I mean, maybe we're wrong. Maybe we're just thinking on too big a level, because obviously regional television was far bigger, obviously before the 90s, where that started to sort of...
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you'd have Les Dawson recording shows in Leeds.
Exactly. So one has got to be careful about how we paint this. But
yeah.
It's a topic which is really interesting, which, if anything, dear listeners, just something to sort of say, have a think about and go and look and make,
definitely
make your own decisions. But yeah, from Tom Baker, it was just large on life and like something I've never seen before in that sort of era. And it wasn't like he was like, as far as I see it, as a big cameo, you know, it's not like John Cleese in City of Death, for instance, if we're to play on the same card.
Now, it's interesting that you say that, because I wouldn't have said John Cleese in City of Death. I would have said John Cleese in God almighty, what's it called?
Well, that's why I didn't use that one, because you don't know what it's called.
I do know what it's called. Why have I lost it just at that moment? John Cleese in the Ripping Yarns episode. Golden Gordon.
Right.
Where he doesn't say anything, he's just walking down the street. As Gordon's wife shouts at him as he leaves the house, and he just turns around and looks at her. That's it. That's all John Cleese does in that. But and of course, John Cleese in Les Dawson sketches in the 70s. Mm-hmm. That would have been a better tie-up, actually. Because he's in two series of Les Dawson's Yorkshire TV show.
But as you say, I mean, the point is he's got a legacy by this point.
Yes, yes.
While Tom Baker here with Sid James does not, and yet is almost cameoing in a way where he does. And that's what's so really crazy about it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I love it. Well, I mean, you check that out again, dear listener. You've obviously heard it. James didn't, but he is aware of it.
I have heard it. Yeah, we did do that at least.
Yeah, and we're as I reported to you in the last podcast, I am trying to get an edit together. It's quite an in-depth interview and quite a detailed subject about the Eternity Clock, and we're hoping to get Philip Bates on with an interview of his new book coming along soon. Hopefully, at least one of those things will be ready before Christmas. There's no Christmas talk to this year, of course, so you might like to check out, I'll stick it in the show notes, our look at all the best Doctor Who Christmas episodes. We'll be back with a new podcast once we've got something else to talk about. Until then, it's goodbye from us.